Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 614. We're a little late this week. It's Thursday, the 8th of August, 2019. I'm Dave Neal. Welcome to the show. And we have with us this week a two-parter. We'll have myself and Andy Corse talking about the British Superbikes from Thruxton later on. But I'd like to welcome to the show John Allen to help me discuss the Suzuka 8-hour that happened recently. John, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Dave.
How are you?
Not too bad. We'll certainly give us a try and see how it goes, and hopefully it makes some interesting points.
Well, I think we've got a good chance of it. You're based down in Southampton on the south coast of the UK, just so our American listeners and our global listeners can understand whereabouts you are. Any further south than you and you get your feet wet, yeah?
It's the Isle of Wight and then continental Europe.
That's it. So, yeah, right down at the very bottom end. You were kind enough to watch the whole of the Suzuka 8 hours, which is a feat in itself, really. I know we were chatting in the morning when I got up because I was on nights that evening. And we had a bit of a chat, and then everything just sort of kicked off in the last 20 minutes, which is the last half an hour, which was a bit of a struggle. But you watched it from the very beginning. And what are your notes, mate? What are your pointers in the early stages of the race?
Well, certainly for the first hour or so, it was a very tight battle. There's a top five or six, very little between them. Lead didn't change hands that much, but there wasn't much of a gap until really the first pit stops, when places obviously changed on the cycles for pit stops, the length they could do on the tank of fuel, so fuel efficiency played a part. And in fact, it was in the first hour that the only pace car came out due to an incident. Rest of the race, it was trouble free.
It sounds like it was a steady old start anyway. I know that it was the main three teams that we were keeping an eye on that were the strongest through qualifying. Leon Haslam, Johnny Ray, and Toprak Raz Gatlioglu on the KRT side. The Yamaha of Alex Lowes, Michael van der Mark, and the Kats Nakasuga.
That's right.
Along with the Honda. I'm doing this off the top of my head as well. With the main Honda effort of Stefan Bradl and Yuki Takahashi. Am I right?
Yes, but I think if I can recall, Kiyonari was actually the nominated third rider, but in fact he didn't come out to play at all during the whole of the race.
There was something that came out of the fact that he was in air quotes ill for that, which maybe translate to not quick enough.
I think that was the feeling behind it. The commentator was discussing, was it better to go three rider route or two? The Honda definitely went the two routes. If I remember rightly, Takahashi was in somewhere in the region of about 5.5 hours actually on the bike out of the eight to about 2.5 with Bradl. Whereas the Works Yamaha, they were doing more even stints, sort of one on, one off. But then Kawasaki's, they kept Toprak as a reserve and they were swapping between Johnny and Leon and doing the stints themselves. And again, he was rested. The commentary team seem to think they're using him more for experience this year with a view to having a proper go at it in 2020.
I would agree, but also I don't think he was quite on the pace enough to, excuse me, in a similar sense to Keo, that he wasn't quite on the pace enough to be able to back up the other two guys, to be able to at least turn the lap times within a second and a half. I think he was quite a little bit further away than that. So it would have made life a little bit difficult for them. And it's not something that they haven't done before.
No.
But certainly to try and take on a very experienced and reigning champions three-rider Yamaha team was impressive from both Kawasaki and from Honda.
Yeah, and say certainly for that first hour or so, there was very little between it. And in fact, as the race went on, there wasn't that much change in actual time gaps. It was more leader on the track positions on the pit stop cycle, refueling. The Honda was certainly getting a few more laps out of a tank of fuel each time. So where perhaps they were doing 23, 24, 25, the Honda was getting sort of another two or three, 26, 27, 28. There was one pit stop in particular which caught the Works Yamaha team out and probably cost them 10 to 15, even possibly 20 seconds overall. They had a problem with the fuel cap, And the designated front tyre man actually had to get the fuel cap open. We've got an old screwdriver, but because that delayed him, he was then out of position to actually get the front tyre change, which actually resulted in a much longer tyre stop. And when they actually printed the accumulated pit stop times after six stops, there was about an 18-second time difference between the quickest team and the slowest. So, yeah, that one stop really hit them hard for that sort of differential.
Was that sort of into the eighth hour? Was that their last stop?
The six stops were coming in sort of towards late 6.5 to 7 hours. Yes, I mean, as I say, the accumulated times there, you were looking going from 4 minutes 15 to about 4:48. So in fact, there was about a half a second difference, which kind of equated to quite often what the gap was on the track. But they're saying that as the race went on, I think the effects on Takahashi were becoming more noticeable. His lap times were slowing down. The humidity was pretty high throughout the race. And it didn't really alter that much as it got later in the day and it turned to dusk. It was still quite humid. And then obviously in the last sort of half an hour or so, when dusk had fallen, you have the darkness. Then we were also getting the rain as well, which only added to the confusion, of course.
Did it ever. And also all the extraneous circumstances which served to try and derail the charging bull that was Jonathan Rea in that last hour. And I know watching it with Takahashi did the last two stints for the HRC machine, and the poor guy was just absolutely knackered by the time that last the most important time of the Suzuka 8 hour is for me that last hour, because you're so tantalizingly close to bringing the bike home and keeping out of trouble and, you know, really nursing her. But Johnny Rea was putting in lap record pace and Alex Lowes was trying to chase him down and Takahashi was tiring. It was a real cat and mouse last sort of 45 minutes, wasn't it?
Actually, it was about 7 hours 20 that Johnny did the fastest lap of the whole race at 2:06.805. So that shows you how hard at that stage of the race he was still going. So he was certainly fitting up for it. And as you say, Alex was riding very well as the darkness came down. And there were quite a few occasions where he was closing the gap and getting closer. And say he got the time back on Takahashi, which I think, as you say, was a combination of overtiredness and possibly dehydration, exhaustion on the one hand. And Alex, with having done the race a few years now, having some pretty good track experience, feeling comfortable on the bike, and being able to set good times.
And good times he did, and he was riding that all-important last stint to close the gap on Takahashi, who, as you said earlier, did he do 5 out of 8 stints or something ridiculous?
It was certainly in that region. I'm just trying to think. I think they actually said later that his actual time on the bike was about 5 hours 37 minutes, which meant Britt Bradl was doing less than about 2.5 hours. So it was almost, we were getting on for double time, weren't we, on that sort of those sort of numbers.
Which is, you know, that's full-on samurai effort, isn't it? You know, he'll be well looked after by HRC for that. But it was that last hour. I was watching it here at home, and it just thinking, well, this is going to turn into absolute barnstormer. And I knew we'd be covering it on the show at some point. And it's like, well, okay, well, the first 7 hours and 15 minutes, there ain't really an awful lot that's happened. Apart from who was the, if you took the notes, who got delayed by 90 seconds?
Right at the start, it was the second Honda, bike's number 634. I think there, if I can remember rightly, there was a problem with sets of tyres on a qualifying lap. And so it was a penalty of 90 seconds, which meant they had that right at the beginning of the race. But in fairness to them, they picked the pace up and throughout the race they did close that gap and they did come back up through the field, but it was quite a hard penalty right from the start.
It is, while everybody else is halfway around the lap. Quite difficult to sit there and wait for everyone to go. I think one of the early casualties was former British Superbike man and double Aussie Superbike champion Josh Waters. He was, as an experienced Suzuka man, unfortunately, he crashed early on and had to pedal the bike back to the pits and lost an awful lot of time there.
Yes, that was quite on, and that was Dan Linford's bike as well, which sort of, as
that's right.
As we've said before, there were quite a few of the BSB regulars who were over there, certainly giving it a good go. I mean, you had Tommy Bridewell, who was out there, and it was good to actually see them when you get onto the Thruxton. Quite a few of them back just a week later, having come through the time zones and the travelling to be fit and ready to go again after a grueling 8 hours at Suzuka.
Without a doubt, and I know it took Josh, I think, 25 hours. Josh Elliott, yep. 25 hours. To return. Then he had a media day at Royal Naval Air Station at Yeovilton for OMG Racing, and then made his way to Thruxton. And I was chatting to his dad over the weekend. The poor lad was absolutely shattered by the time he got there. It's economy all the way. There's none of this business class flying or anything like that. So it's a tough journey, but one that gets well rewarded, and the guys are well thought of that contest the Suzuka 8 Hour.
Yeah, I think the factory do like the participation. I mean, it was this time last year that Bradley Ray had such a good run, and I think that really rose his stock within Suzuki, what he did for them last year. And although he wasn't on the full works bike this year, it was the S-Pulse Suzuki, and that is semi-factory, so it was still getting a lot of support. So, yeah, himself and Tommy Bridewell, although they weren't the full Suzuki team, they were certainly getting factory support. And of course, it's so important to the factory teams out there,
and it always will be.
I think in some ways even more so than MotoGP, it's the honor, I think, of winning the Suzuka 8 Hours, isn't it?
I fully agree, and it's something that when you look at the superbikes that they wheel out, they are the most incredible pieces of kit that ever was a production, in air quotes, production motorcycle racing. They are the absolute pinnacle of superbike tech.
And also the Team 21 Yamaha, I love that colour scheme on that bike.
The baby blue.
The baby blue, yes.
It's fabulous. It's sort of harking back almost to the Rizla Suzuki days.
It's not that dissimilar. I think it went back to when the team was racing in the 80s, if I remember. They were saying it was harking back to the colour schemes they were using on the bike then. So it was sort of a tribute to the success they had in the earlier years in the race. And Alex was riding with a tribute crash helmet.
Kenny Roberts.
That's right, yeah.
That was a beautiful, beautiful shark helmet in the old Yamaha America white, yellow and black with the bald eagle on either side of the lid. Yeah. Was a lovely touch from Alex Lowe's that to Kenny Roberts and to Yamaha themselves to their heritage, which was outstanding. Now, excuse me, what a frog in my throat tonight. This is not doing too well at all. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'll just clear my throat. Towards the end of the race, this is when things started to get a little bit exciting. Johnny Ray was, as you said, he'd put the fastest lap of the race in with about 7 hours and 20 minutes elapsed. But then he had a bit of a scare, didn't he, as he came around one of the back markers coming out of turn one. You could see in the track that there was an exhaust end can.
That's right, yeah. So there's a natural piece of exhaust lying on the track, and it's him and one of the other bikes, and they just basically came across it very late and rode either side of it. I'm just trying to see in my notes if I can remember who the other bike was, but It was almost more by luck than chance that they actually managed to avoid it. And this is when it all really sort of started to, shall we say, fall apart, in that the rain was starting to fall a bit more. Obviously, dusk was becoming darker, and the track was getting a bit greasy. And even at that time, not just on the race result, but the World Championship was still virtually nothing, neck and neck between the Cert Suzuki and the Kawasaki. Throughout the hours, they'd be doing the virtual positions if a flag were to fall there. And most of the time, there was only 1 and 2 points between them, because it was double points because it was the last championship round. So that meant that where in previous rounds, I think every team had had 1 or 2 bad results. But of course, with double points, they could now close up. And as I say, for much of the race, Cert was leading by 1 point, then Kawasaki were leading by 2 points, and it was toing and froing. But Cert slightly had the upper hand. They came in for quite a late-ish splash and dash to try and maintain their position, which they actually came back out and still had the lead. But then it's about that, well, it was a little bit later than sort of half an hour to go. We were down to about 10 minutes. And that's when the problems really started to occur, and the pictures were showing the bike with smoke coming out of its back end.
I think most people were shouting at the TV at that point for Etienne Masson to actually get the fuck off the circuit. You could see what was happening with his bike. Obviously, it was dark at that point, so it's difficult for him to see. There was a championship at stake also. And there was, not for the team manager, but for those of us watching on the TV, a fantastic range of emotion in the Cert garage, where the team boss was happy and they were not congratulating each other at that point, but you could see he was positive. They were buoyant that they were going to win the championship. There was literally, I think, 4 minutes left of the Suzuka 8 hour. His rider had gone back out, they'd maintained position on the track, and then all of a sudden his whole demeanour changed as he saw the bike blow up. It was dropping oil. Eventually he pulled off the circuit, but by that point the damage was done and he'd left oil across the circuit, and of course it had started to rain as well, which is causing problems enough for the rest of the riders trying to keep it afloat on two wheels.
That's right. I mean, I think there was a school of thought he was trying to stay out in the hope that they would red flag it, and therefore that would give them the championship. But they kept running the race at that time, and as you say, sort of literally in the next shot, we were going to see Johnny in the dirt and everything breaking loose, shall we say.
They were, and then that's when all the problems happened, because then Johnny hit the deck, he couldn't get the bike restarted, the race was subsequently red flagged, and the announcement was given to the Yamaha squad.
That's right, yeah. I think they were working along the lines of, because Johnny hadn't got the bike back to Parc Fermé within 5 minutes of a red flag.
Now, this goes back to World Superbikes at Donington, doesn't it, with Tom Sykes?
It certainly raises that.
So that goes back to Tom Sykes was excluded from the results after Hickey's bike blew up and left oil on the way down to Melbourne Loop. Tom Sykes crashed, bike barrel rolled through, couldn't get the bike back within the allotted 5 minutes. That is a World Superbike rule.
That's right, yeah.
However, it's not a World Endurance rule.
No, from what I can make out, it looks like it's a rule they are going to implement, or they are still discussing implementing it. But at this time, it's not actually been enforced. So therefore, Johnny Ray was under no compulsion to actually get the bike back to Parc Fermé within 5 minutes of a red flag incident.
No, so the amount of issues and the watching the threads on the social channels, nobody really seemed to know what was happening. Of course, Yamaha had they were crowned at the point of the red flag and the point of the celebrations and the podium. They were crowned champions of the Suzuka 8 hour for what would have been the fifth time.
That's right, and the t-shirts were coming out and there were pictures of them, you know, obviously celebrating. But in fairness to Mickey van der Mark, I mean, he was saying he didn't want to win it that way and it didn't feel right and he wasn't comfortable. And he almost looked quite dejected. He felt sorry that they were getting the race win through when they didn't deserve to.
I agree. And I think Alex Lowes was magnanimous and I'm sure that he made that statement as well, and it wasn't written on behalf of the team by the team PR man and communications manager Ian Wheeler. But it was the whole team were magnanimous, and yes, they had the celebrations, yes, they had the garlands, yes, they had the t-shirts out. But then a couple of hours later, there was soon after the end of the race, Kawasaki put a protest in, which then subsequently a couple of hours later overturned the result.
That's right. And I think by then, Johnny and Leon had gone back to the hotel, and it sounds as though they were having a few drinks to commiserate. Word came back through that the appeal had been successful and they had to be rushed back to the circuit so that subsequent press conferences could be held for the for the amended winners.
Which, at the end of the day, the the victor took the spoils, and that's how it should have been. It would have been quite a hollow victory for Yamaha. I mean, Yamaha didn't deserve to lose it. They were. What was the gap at the end of the race eventually?
I think it was down to. I think it's down to about 15, 18 seconds, if that. On the initial result, with Johnny Ray being excluded, we'd had Team 21 at 2.16 laps, Team 33 at 48 seconds, which was the bigger gap.
Which is what? Yeah, that's right. There was a bigger gap between Alex and Takahashi than there was between Alex and Johnny. So
that's right.
Because they both overhauled Takahashi in the last sort of 15, the last half an hour or so, as he tired massively. And was disappointing for him and for the HRC team. But yeah, I think Johnny had held station. He wasn't looking at being caught. The weather was throwing in a bit of a curveball. But for me, the right team won. The right team came second. And unfortunately for Honda, the right team came third, because that strategy to put Takahashi out for the last two was really just something that's cost them the race.
As you say, I think that's what killed them. They just used the wrong rider strategy. I think they really relied too much on his track knowledge. And yes, he was very fast, certainly to start with. But I just think they were asking too much of him to do as much riding as he did in such a short space of time, given the conditions, the humidity. I mean, the amount of fluids he must have been taking on to try and keep himself going. I think, as you say, they just got the strategy wrong. The bike was good, and they had the advantage of enhanced fuel usage, so they were being able to stretch the window and get a few extra laps in. I mean, I think they were always working on one fuel stop less than the other bikes, because they could get that a couple of extra laps. But then that time was lost, and in bigger numbers to the fact that they overused one rider,
and that's what cost them, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It was, as you alluded to earlier on, it was good to see the Brit boys up there as well, and all giving their best shot for Suzuka for this year. We had, as you rightly said, we had Dan Linfoot out there. We had Tommy Bridewell. Dan Linfoot, Tommy Bridewell, Danny Buchan. Bjorn Esmond was out there, the South African stock 1000 rider. Josh Elliott was out there. James Ellison was a late call up for it as well. And obviously we said Josh Waters, who is an honorary British superbike rider, although he's now back out in Australia for Suzuki. It was a good turnout for the boys, and Bradley Ray, of course. They all acquitted themselves well, I thought.
Yes, as I say, I mean, I think they've certainly got a lot to be proud of. I think everyone put in good stints, and they achieved, you know, good results. Okay, it was Johnny and Leon and Alex, you know, on the works bikes, which were up the sharp end, but they were certainly running steady races midfield. They were battling amongst themselves and amongst the other bikes. There were some close battles between Tommy and Brad's team against the Morawaki. There were some quite long close battles there, sort of middle of a race, and they were trading places. No, I think everyone's got a lot to be proud of.
I think they, as you say, they acquitted themselves well, and I think they all, apart from, if I've not checked the results, apart from Dan Linfoot, I think all finished in the top 25.
I can't say either way on that, but yes, I think on the whole they all performed very well. As you say, certainly within the sort of top half of the field. Although saying that, actually, for retirements, it was not that many for, you know, a good, reasonable, steady pace. I think initially they were hoping to do 220 laps and break the record, but the winner was coming out about 2.16, which with that one pace car would potentially have knocked one or two laps off. So they weren't far off the pace they were hoping to run.
No, which is really impressive. And what was overall of the 8 hours, what were the highlights for you?
Staying awake. No, I actually saying that, it wasn't an issue, because it was an exciting race. You know, from lap one right through to the end. Obviously, the last 20 minutes or so really peaked. But certainly that first hour and a half, and then you had the regular cycle of the pit stops. And, you know, there's trading places there and forming back into midfield to work their way back through as the cycle went through. Keeping a track of who was on and off the bikes and what sort of lap times they were doing. No, I'd say it was certainly compared to previous years when I've got up at such an early time to watch it. And yeah, it certainly ranks as one of my favourite races of the year, I must admit.
Wonderful. I think that was a most comprehensive of recaps. And for your first time on the show, John, I think that was a sterling effort.
Well, thank you very much.
How have you enjoyed it?
Yes. Having done this one, I would certainly be happy to try and join you and make some notes on some other races and certainly put something forward.
Wonderful. Let's see if we can do something with that going forward. I'm now going to join Andy Corse for a review of the British Superbikes from Thruxton over this last weekend. You can have a well-earned rest and read back through your notes and breathe, because I know how difficult it is on the first appearance on Motopod. On behalf of all of us at Motopod, thank you for compiling the notes. Thank you for joining us. And also thank you, John, for staying away.
You're most welcome. Hopefully I can speak to everyone again soon.
I'll look forward to it. Thanks for all your help.
Bye now.
Speak to you soon, mate. Well, after a brief interlude for a little comfort break and a refill of my drink, we're back on it again with a little zoom. And I'm now joined by my usual partner in crime for the British Superbike review of Thruxton that we're about to go through, Andy Corse. Andy, good evening, mate.
Good evening, Dave. How you doing?
Really good, really good. Quite enjoyed the chat with John that you've all just listened to cover Suzuka. Nice to hear a fresh voice on the show and one that maybe we could bring in again sometime. I hope you guys listening all enjoyed it, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I thought it was especially nice of him to take the time to follow the Suzuka, because, I mean, obviously, it's a quite a long-winded event.
It's a good 8 hours.
But this year as well was really quite something special, as I'm sure you guys covered.
Yeah, especially that last half an hour. That really did throw things to the wind a little bit. But now we've covered the events in the Far East. We're closer to home now.
Yeah, and what a fantastic round seven of the Bennett's British Superbike Championship from Thruxton Circuit in Hampshire. I mean, a pretty exciting round that saw a new name top of the podium this year for the first time, I think, this year.
Yeah, first time ever, I think you'll find.
And only two rounds and, what, five races to go, two, before the start of the showdown.
Indeed.
One thing I did want to do is I just wanted to say a quick shout out and a thank you to the donors. I have the list. Scott Saunter, thank you very, very, very much. I also want to thank a number of our patrons: Peter Newell, Carl Marsh, Germund Melvitt. I never know if I pronounce that name correctly. If I'm butchering that, please do write in and help us with that. I'm doing my best. Warren Pond, Lester NG, Steve and Gary Shevitt, thank you very much. Indeed, your continued support really helps and is good to see. Now, just before you gave me a call for this chat, I was just, I don't know if you've caught this, but literally breaking news, apart from the fact that Peter Hickman is kicking ass at the Ulster Grand Prix, Jorge Lorenzo rumoured to be going to Pramac Ducati for 2020.
I've heard this also. Now, I tried to tickle from a distance, obviously, the good Lord Harry Lloyd, formerly of this parish, this afternoon to see just what the lay of the land was. And all he would give me was that it will be tricky for him to do what he wants to do. But for me, that says that it's not beyond the realms of possibility.
I caught an interview with Jack Miller. I guess this is probably just leading into the Austrian Grand Prix.
Yes, it was a press conference this afternoon, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was. And I think from that, I happened to listen to a small soundbite, which was published on the second best podcast, the Paddock Pass podcast.
Steve English, if you're listening to this, it's joint first.
Second only to us. And it was, yeah, Jack Miller saying that perhaps there could well be some truth to the rumours. I think, Jack was saying from his standpoint, he was trying to find, I guess, some sort of logical explanation why his contract renewal was taking a little longer than maybe had been planned. It sounded from his standpoint, Pramac were totally happy with him. They had agreed to everything. But obviously, Ducati is really on the hook for the machinery and probably for a good chunk of the rider salary as well. And it sounds like someone over there, what did he quote? He said, was having fond memories of the past and was maybe sort of holding this up I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I think on the one hand, Jorge Lorenzo, I don't think it's been quite as easy as he thought. I have a feeling he's maybe got the sense now that that bike is going to be a lot harder for him to tame. Sure. Now he's actually ridden it. I also think, too, that as much as Honda would value his input to make that Honda more rideable for a wider range of riders, I have a feeling that Marquez, understandably, wants to keep that thing an absolute unrideable beast.
Of course he does. You wouldn't want someone, you know, you're not going to teach it, give someone an opportunity to unlock the secrets of the one thing that keeps you the number one rider in the world, to be able to then challenge you for that number one rider in the world status. One piece that I did pick up on from Jack Miller, that he says, when Jorge returns from the Maldives or wherever he is, then we maybe will find out more. Which, in true Jack Miller style, that really did make me smile. But yeah, there's clearly mileage in this, because these rumours don't come about offhand. Sometimes they do. But then I think that, such is the nature of the journalists in the paddock nowadays, online, in the, with the likes of Manuel Pacino, Matt Oxley still out there. The guys like that, I was going to quote one for MCN, but suddenly they don't have one anymore. The likes of Peter McLaren, David Emmett, Neil Morrison, there's some real good, strong journalists out there. And I think that very little these days gets to this standard without carrying some kind of credibility. So I have no doubts that there is something going on behind the scenes. I have no doubts that Jorge Lorenzo wants off that Honda. Now, I had real high hopes for him going there. He was average at Valencia. He was good at Jerez. He was outstanding at Sepang, if you remember rightly. Didn't he go fastest?
Yep.
And then it all went to shit.
Yep.
And I don't get it. I really don't get it. He's in danger of losing. He's like he had on his helmet earlier in the year, still always a champion. Something along those lines. He had a little mantra on the back of his lid. And they'll never take that away from him. But I think at this point in time, there's more chance of Valentino Rossi winning another championship than Jorge Lorenzo, unless Jorge goes back to a Yamaha.
Well, I think, unfortunately, Jorge has been a victim of his injuries. From what I understand, I think this is the difficulty he's had. And this is why, you know, with the Ducati, you remember years back, he was trying to find the support, the physical support that he needed under braking. Because he, with the injuries that he had, he just could not do the upper body training, the sort of the muscle training that he needed.
Strength and conditioning.
Yeah. So he, you know, he might have the muscle conditioning to last, you know, with the extreme braking forces for, you know, the first third of the race. But then after that, he's just, you know, exhausted. So as I understood it, a lot of what he was trying to seek with all the seats and all the other adjustments, the tank support and everything, was a way of using, you know, legs. Sort of bracing his body, using his legs to try and take a little bit of the stress off his upper body, off his upper arms, to allow them to last the race.
Ergonomics.
Yeah, the Yamaha suited that, because you could make the speed with the corner speed. Ducati certainly, and a degree to the Honda, at least last year's Honda, you know, they were making their lap time by being, you know, hard on the brakes, getting it thing turned, and then getting it stood up and, you know, using the power. Mark's had an easier time, I think, this year, as they've got some of the acceleration sorted out, so he hasn't had to work quite so hard braking into the corners. But the Ducati, I think, is still very much like that. And yeah, you know, I have a fear that, you know, although he has the sort of the championship mentality and the speed, unless it's married with a very, very particular bike, I'm not sure if we'll ever see the best of him again.
100% agreed. And I think that is where they're at. If Jack's alluding to the fond memories of riding the Bologna Bullet last year and his victories that he took, and he probably could be fighting for a championship this year had he not made the decision to jump to Repsol Honda. I genuinely think he could have been a contender this year, because Dovi doesn't seem to be on the par with... Let's be fair, Mark is on a different plane, isn't he? It's not the fact that Dovi probably isn't as strong as last year. The rest of the rest of the field are good and strong within their own field. Mark is just head and shoulders above. I was reading this afternoon, there was a thread that involved our own Len Padilla. And it was one that actually Len had instigated. And David Emmett was coming on saying, yeah, but MotoGP's boring now. And I just couldn't do with reply. I was at work and I just couldn't do with replying. I know what I wanted to say, but trying to get it across maybe would have elicited the wrong response from certain people. But for me, I enjoyed the Bruno race because I watch Marc Marquez in the same way that I've watched Casey Stoner previously, and the longer term listeners to the show will understand this. When that happens, I actually watch racing a different way. I actually just enjoy watching Marc Marquez at his best, because he ain't going to be around forever. You know, there will come a time where he's not racing anymore, and that incredible bike control, in the same way that I adored watching Casey Stoner and just fighting and battling and doing things on a motorcycle that other people aren't doing. Yes, it's great to have a race. Yes, it's great to have the bumping and the barging and the fantastic racing that we had at Thruxton on Sunday. But you have to change your mindset with how you watch racing, how you want to watch racing. You either want to watch the cut and the thrust, which we all enjoy, or you can actually just revise how you do it, and actually, instead of looking at the racing, you end up watching Marc Marquez. You watch how he moves his body around on the bike. You watch how he drops into a corner. Try and take everything you can and understand what the guy is doing, because it gives you an opportunity to see his body position, to see what he's doing with his legs, trying to force that bike over, the lean angle that he gets, and the fact that he can be so close to the ground. And in some of these high motion shots from the weekend, that he was at a ridiculous late 50s lean angle, but neither his knee or his elbow was touching the floor.
Yeah, I think he got that thing over to 60 degrees. And this is his point as he got onto the testing in Monday. He's saying, like, you know, we need to find a way to get this Honda to turn without me having to take these extreme lean angles. I mean, to your point, I watched the Bruno Grand Prix. I mean, I'm really loving MotoGP right now. I think we're in a golden era. I mean, we've had some excellent races, and no way can you have all GP races at that level. But just, you know, watching the MotoGP race itself, I can understand someone saying it was maybe a bit boring. But for me, and it blew my doors off. I think we got to about halfway through the race. Mark's comfortably in the lead. He's controlling it. He's doing everything he needs to manage the tire. He's got a gap. And then maybe about two-thirds through the race, he decides to just go. He decides to just decimate the field. He decides to just demonstrate what he can truly do if he wants to. I mean, talk about shock and awe. I mean...
Yeah.
It just comprehensively fucked off.
And this is on what the, I mean. On that this bike, is taking exactly risks the point
he didn't
I was
need
making.
To do, but just this kind of like absolute demonstration of a mastery of the gap that potentially exists when he's got that bike on the, you know, the right day on the right track and everything. And yeah, to your point, I don't think Dovi has an answer for that. Even on a comparable bike, I don't think Dovi in that company is not championship material. And the one thing I did lift out of this little Paddock Pass podcast when they were talking about this potential for Jorge to move to Pramac was obviously a big guiding light within Ducati is Gigi Deligno. And the fact that Gigi and Dovizioso supposedly don't seem to be having the best of relationships. And to some extent, they're saying like they're almost not talking now. And I think this is sort of Gigi basically recognizing that Dovi, in his mind, just doesn't have the championship-winning potential. So Ducati have a choice. You know, who do you change out? Do you change out the rider, or do you change out Gigi?
Didn't they try that before with Filippo Preziosi with Casey Stoner? That's when Gigi came in, wasn't it? They weren't sure whether it was the rider or whether it was the engineer.
Well, I think if Gigi came in the back of Valentino leaving Ducati, where, you know, I think Valentino's frustration was saying, like, you know, the factory engineers were not in line and not supporting the race team. Their feedback of what the riders and the team wanted was not being honoured and delivered by the factory. The factory were turning up with what they thought was important. And my understanding is, like, a big element of Gigi coming in out of World Superbike from Aprilia was to help organise that sort of reporting and management line. So there's a big management shakeup.
Yes.
I think at the factory, really geared around supporting the team. And don't forget, Gigi also incorporated all the satellite Ducati teams as well to make them one big family and to gather and profit from a huge amount of feedback. And I think that really helped accelerate the Ducati project to bring them where they are now.
I would agree wholeheartedly, yeah. Now, when you said that who as a championship challenge, Dovi has faded. This weekend at the Red Bull Ring will be the biggest marker yet to see just what Dovi has in the tank. Because it's Ducati's favourite track, isn't it? There's no two ways about it. Dovi won the last two races there.
It is. I mean, it's a point and squirt track. It's, you know, 90 degree corner, squirt, accelerate. 90 degree corner, squirt, accelerate. I mean, in some respects, it's made for the Ducati. But don't forget, the Honda now is, I think, a different bike to previous years.
This is it.
And they have the ability to compete on that as well. And, you know, even the Yamahas potentially could be in the mix. Maybe not the factories, but I think Quartararo's demonstrated that he can get some acceleration out of that bike as well. So if he can be near the front, who knows?
Strange when you say that. You think, oh, when the Yamahas could be close. The first one I thought of was a Petronas.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't, at the right. moment, not we're the not thinking of the factory team because not the factory, Maverick's yeah. nowhere near and Valentino is sort of fifth, sixth, seventh.
Well, it's been bizarre. It's been like they have Vinales, who seems to be able to do it on the Saturday, but not on the Sunday. And then they have Rossi, who seems to not be able to do it on the Saturday, but he seems to be able to do it on the Sunday.
But that's why he wins at testing all the time, because he can do that one fast lap.
Well, yeah, but we all know that testing is not representative. Testing typically on a track that's covered in MotoGP rubber. So things like traction issues and all the other stuff that they typically complain about are masked or covered.
You so mean testing's not real?
It's who was it, KTM I think was saying that they've typically rented the tracks after the Moto2 test, so they do their testing the day after a whole track's been smeared with Moto2 Dunlop rubber, which they typically find fairly slippy, which for them replicates what they think, you know, are closer to be race conditions.
Which they would be, because they've invariably follow Moto2 anyway, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Which I could never understand, because they don't during qualifying and free practice.
No, I know.
It doesn't make any sense.
I guess that's the, you know, that's the spectacle for the Sundays, leaving the premier event for the sort of early afternoon.
But then they don't. Then they have to race on the Dunlop rubber, where they don't during free practice and qualifying.
Exactly.
Weird.
I know.
We've done MotoGP, that's the first.
I know, but it was one of those things that I wanted to kind of, I know I wanted to leave it to Jim and the boys, but you know what I mean? It's too big a juicy thing to not talk about. So should we just talk about some of the BSB news that came out of the previous round? And I think the first thing was probably the Glenn Irwin leaving the Quattro plant Kawasaki and heading to Tyco.
Which, none of it was a massive surprise when you look at the results that Glenn's been having, the struggles that he's been going through, and the amount of bikes he's written off. It's been a torrid season for the Carrick Fergus man, and it was almost inevitable. Once you get halfway through the season, the seat swapping starts. It happens every year in BSB. Somebody's either injured or below par on their results, and they try to look elsewhere, both the team and or the rider, look to try and salvage a season, because they have to look towards the following season to gain a ride. So when Glenn parted company after Snetterton, no, he didn't ride at Snetterton, but when he parted company with the team after Snetterton, it was no shock to see him jump on the Tyco BMW. He has hinted about doing the TT next year. He's already a winner around the Northwest 200 circuit. So already with one eye on 2020, this could be the best audition possible for a ride next year for Glenn Irwin, at the expense of the unfortunately injured Keith Farmer. We don't know how soon Keith will be back, if he'll be back at all this season. That's still open for debate, and waiting to hear officially from the man himself. But yeah, it was absolutely no surprise at all. And then for the announcement prior to the Thruxton weekend that Hector Barbera would stay with Quattro Plant JG Speedfit for the year, that was no shock either. We knew that was coming because of the results he'd put in. And then promptly had his worst race weekend of the year.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about Glenn's race weekend as well. So we've done a little bit of MotoGP. We've done a little bit of British Superbikes. Would you like to do just a quick touch on some World Superbike, just to sort of, you know, get the trifecta?
Go on, then.
So latest World Superbike rumours. I don't know if you've heard any of this.
A little.
Bautista to Honda.
Yeah.
Redding to Ducati, Takahashi to Honda, Kamiya then over to BMW, Top Rack after having been left out of the Suzuka, pissed off at Kawasaki, so now over to Yamaha, so that's Lowe's out.
I believe that's almost a done deal.
Then Laverty to Pichetti to take over from Top Rack.
Which is the Phil Maran connection.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So some of this we've heard before, but this now all starts to sort of tie together into a neat little narrative.
It does. It's all come up. This, if you'd have asked this 6-8 weeks ago, I would have disagreed with the majority of it. And I think quite possibly even the majority of it wouldn't even be written down, because Alvaro Bautista was on course to win his first World Superbike crown, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So he was the Ducati darling, but since then he's got about as much balance as my grandma, and can complete as many races as probably she could, and she's been dead 6 years. I'm kidding. It's been a difficult time for Alvaro, and one that has cost him potentially a lucrative deal for next year. And I know this year he's not particularly underpaid by any stretch. He's been brought in by Ducati to win that World Superbike Championship back from Kawasaki. For me, 100%, it's not going to happen. There needs to be another almighty swing. With the confidence that JR's got from Suzuka, the assistance that they'll be giving him to secure that fifth world title will be unprecedented. So Alvaro Bautista has a massive fight on his hands. And with the rumour of a new Honda Fireblade, or a new Honda, whether it's a Fireblade or if it's an all-new machine with something else, coming for next year, and the fact that the Morawaki team of Chris Pike and the rest of the guys there are doing groundwork for that bike for next season, to have someone like Alvaro Bautista on it would be a massive shot in the arm for them. They need a strong representative for it. Now, I wondered if Alex Lowe's could end up there, whether they would keep Leon Kamiya there, because he's never had the opportunity to shine in World Superbikes. He's gone from sort of shed to shed to shed almost. Or he's had a good bike, but the efforts have been on the other rider. So he's never really had the opportunity, and he's been beset with injury problems as well, as he has been this year. So I wondered if he'd be ready to make that step back to BSB and see what Scott Redding's done, to come back, do a control, alt and delete, and then go again. I mean, I think Leon Kamiya, he's getting on a bit now. He's greying up and those wrinkles are really kicking in. So, you know, he's not as young and as good looking and as eruditely handsome as he used to be. So maybe that will go against him as well.
Give it a break. This is just because you're beating up on him because he's Jen's favourite.
Maybe.
but the rumour is he's off to BMW. to replace Reuterberger.
But then there's rumours that Scott Redding's going there as well.
Redding to Ducati to replace Bautista. Keep up, Dave.
Wow. This is it. You see, everything is moving. This could be the silliest silly season that we've ever had in the history of silly seasons, because there are few done deals at the moment. And I was listening to BSB Radio at Thruxton before the weekend. Stuart Higgs was on. Was it before Thruxton or before Snetterton? I can't remember. And Stuart Higgs was talking about silly season and rider changes and the lineup for 2020. And he was intimating that Sam Lowes could arrive, who has since signed another deal in Moto2, but he has yet to announce, which most paddock believers seem to think it will be at Mark VDS to replace Alex Marquez.
Which I find kind of surprising. What did you think?
I'm amazed.
I'm not sure if Sam's results in my mind...
No, exactly. You know, this was supposed to be the... I have a lot of time, a lot of respect for Sam.
Absolutely.
Sam Lowes has everything he needs for this season. This is what he said at the start of the year, that he has the bike, he has the team, he has everything that he can to put a championship challenge together. And it's just not happened. So... why he's ended up on a Mark VDS machine. If that's right, then I suspect that Alex Marquez will go to the Petronas SRT Moto2 team, with then a look to step up to MotoGP in 2021. So he really needs to come up with the goods for 2020, or he will be back in BSB in 2021.
Okay, so talking about BSB, let's just finish up the news section. Bring it back to BSB, because there was a little bit of news, I guess, going into Thruxton. And one of the things was Beewiser PBM will no longer necessarily be on the grid. I think PBM will still be there next year, but after 4 years, the Beewiser insurance, that very, very iconic owl logo, will be missing off of their bikes.
Certainly will. And I think two of those seasons have been champions with Shane Byrne. And I think I would put a relatively large chunk of my mortgage on the fact that there's going to be a red Beewiser bike at the top of the championship at the end of this season too.
Yeah, agreed. It may not be Scott. May not be Scott Renning, but if it's not, it's going to be Josh Brooks. I think it's clearly going to be one of the two.
Without a doubt.
And probably we'll have a red bike for them next year. But it will be interesting to see who they source as a sponsor for next year. I mean, they're a top flight team, no question. Previous championship winners. You know, for me, sometimes I think this is more the benchmark of the health of a sport, is to see, you know, who they can attract in to sponsor, you know, a premium team like that. Hopefully it's a nice big brand name. You know, you tend to think too, you know, if they can bring in someone good, that in turn will bring in other brand name sponsors for some of the other teams, and will just all help and contribute to, you know, the health of the series.
Yeah, that's the idea, isn't it? I mean, Beewiser have been around for quite a while. They were initially in Stock 600 supporting Russo Racing at one point. Then they went on to do their own superbike team with Chris Walker at the helm and running Danny Buchan when it was the Beewiser Kawasaki. And then obviously they switched to Paul Bird's team with a huge amount of success. It was originally a 3-year deal, as you say, but then it went on to for an extra year. So they've already done their time in that sense, and hanging on for an extra year as well shows their commitment not only to Paul Bird Motorsport, but to the sport as a whole.
Yeah, and the other last little bit of news, I guess it was no big surprise, but Hector Barbera has been confirmed as the rider for the remainder of 2019 with the Quattroplant JG Speedfit Kawasaki team.
Yeah, nobody really spilt their coffee back over the keyboards after reading that one, did they? Once Glenn Irwin had departed the team, I think it was, as the saying goes, as sure as eggs is eggs, that Hector Barbera will be kept on for the rest of the season. And don't be surprised if he signs up for 2020 as well.
Yeah, agree. Which, I think. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. Which, on the Friday, watching the Eurosport live, like Facebook Live thing that Matt Roberts does on a Friday, you get some really interesting little snippets on that. There's only like 35 or 36 people watching it, but they're all sat there in their anorak, zipped right up, namely people like me. And Javier Simeon was in the Honda Racing Garage supporting Xavi Forres at the weekend. And Matt asked him if he was actively looking for a ride in British Superbikes next season, to which he replied, yes.
Yeah, that'd be interesting because maybe... Let's talk about that at the end of it, because there is, even for this year, potentially a decent seat up for grabs for the remainder of the season. But we'll talk about that, I think, at the end of Thruxton. Just before we do move on, though, I was just happened to sort of like keeping a track on the Ulster, which is going on, because a lot of the riders after Thruxton did basically jump. I was going to say jump on the plane, but you know. Been more on the ferry, wasn't it, to get over to ride the Ulster. And the one thing I did see was Pete Hickman, after some pretty good performances we'll talk about at Thruxton, kicking ass basically at the Ulster. Took the win in the Superbike and in the Supersport.
Yeah, I think this is payback for not winning the Senior TT back in June. Hickey is just the most complete road racer in the world at the moment. I don't think there's any doubt in that. And arguably, how's that? Arguably the most complete road racer in the world at this point in time. And it just beggars belief. The video that BBC NI posted today of his 136.415 mile per hour average speed lap. Yes, I know it's not as fast as Barry Sheen at Spa when he did 137, but just this is something special without a shadow of a doubt. And he's raising the bar, I think, to a level that I don't know if the other guys are prepared to go that far. Do you know what I mean? It's like, do you know what, Pete? If you want it that bad, you take it. You know, they weren't a huge amount of distance behind. It's not like he shot off into the distance. But his just overall pace was too much for Dean Harrison and Connor Cummins.
Yeah, I think, again, you know, we'll talk about this before, but again, it's pretty impressive. You know, Pete was talking about he felt that he was still a bit down on power compared to the ZX-10, but I think he's just gelled so completely with that BMW, partly probably because of the laps he does do during BSB. But you know, I think it's a complete package. It's Pete, it's the bike, and it's also the team and their absolutely knowledge and experience when it comes to road racing. And all of them together are really delivering just, you know, top draw performance. You know, it's really impressive to watch.
And that is a seriously tight-knit team with Daz Jones as his crew chief. You have Luke and his name was there. I can see his face. James Buckingham, ex-racer James Buckingham's along with them as well. And just the bike itself helps as well, doesn't it? Because it's such a sweet handling machine, as Tom Sykes has proven at World Superbike level, and what Pete was doing at the TT in the summer. It's an incredible package. And as you rightly say, it's just that perfect mix of rider ability and bike. What's the word I'm looking for? It seems compliant for him. It doesn't seem to be forcing it to do what he wants it to do. They are quite as one.
Yeah, agreed. You know, and right now I think that combination of those three are the package, package to beat. So
it's a super hard package to beat, without a shadow of a doubt.
I know. I think they're sort of like fighting the weather today, but hopefully things pick up for them. But let's move on to Thruxton.
Do it.
Because, definitely a few people were talking about the GP maybe not being that exciting, but oh my goodness, the racing from Thruxton this past weekend, really, really enjoyable. I mean, it's a fast, wide track. You're just constantly, constantly on the side of the tyre. There's definitely a few different lines through that track, which we saw. Yeah, really, really impressive to watch. And, you know, we're getting down to, I think we said before, you know, it's like, Two more rounds, five races.
So
it's all starting to get a bit tight for that sort of last place, two places. Maybe in the showdown currently, we have Danny Buchan in fifth, 132 points. Chavy Forrest in sixth, hanging on to that place right now with 114. But nipping at his heels is Pete Hickman on the BMW 96. Andrew Irwin, Chavy Forrest's teammate, 94. And Christian Iden in ninth on 92. And I think really those are the three men who are basically trying to steal away maybe that last spot from Chavy, maybe even Danny, if they get the run.
Not only that, but the small Scotsman on the McCam Yamaha, as we'll talk about as well.
That's true. He's not invulnerable, is he?
No, it was a pivotal weekend in a lot of ways at Thruxton, and I completely agree. The racing, let's just take it to base level. It was fucking incredible.
Yeah, race one.
Seriously.
Race one was just...
It was just some of the best British superbike racing. The best bike racing that I've seen in an awful long time. And if Stuart Higgs and his team want to put an advert out to the world of what British superbike racing is about, and everybody who listens knows I'm a massive fan of the series. It has its faults, it has its ups and downs, but I love it for what it is. And that racing, for to see Scott Redding do what he did, for Josh Brooks to fight back, for Jason O'Halloran to be up there, Andy Irwin stamping his authority on the series at long last. And it was just phenomenal. Tommy Bridewell making a cameo. It was open to anyone, wasn't it? Race two maybe not so much, but race one was open to anybody. It just cost a small couple of tenth of a second mistake for anyone to be then relegated back to fifth place from the lead. It was just stunning.
Yeah. So let's have a quick whiz through the qualifying. In some respects, I don't think the qualifying was anything overly surprising, other than the unfortunate departure of Taran McKenzie in Q1.
Yeah, he did. Taran lost the rear of his McCam Yamaha R1 and unfortunately fractured his radius in his left wrist. He had the operation to fix it yesterday, which was Thursday. No, today. Today's Thursday. MotoPod Time Machine getting mixed up. And the prognosis, we don't know yet as how far he will be before his recovery is allowing him back on a motorcycle. He's a racer, so chances are if he's cleared to race by the BSB medics, he will race at Cadwell Park. But he's thrown an awful lot of points away again this weekend, and I think that's going to damage his season. That's going to be the difficult point of his season, are his DNFs, because they've mainly been for crashes. And if this keeps him out of Cadwell Park, this really will shake up the showdown bottom three, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I think to lose the points from two rounds over this weekend was bad enough, but maybe not fatal. But like you say, another two at Cadwell, and I think, unfortunately, he's down out, which is such a shame. I mean, he showed incredible determination, incredible pace early on, but you're right. Unfortunately, those little oopsies have just really cost him.
They have, but he's the only one, really, that's taking it to, or at the earlier in the, to the middle of the season, he was the only one really taking it to the PBM Ducatis.
Consistently, so, you're right. I mean, I think his teammate had some pace, but not consistently over a weekend.
No,
and
he had,
it was him who
Jason's
just seemed
had
to have that.
So much bad luck, as we said.
Yeah.
And that's what's really held Jason back. But the crashes are now starting to hold Taz back.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when I look at qualifying, I think for me, looking at the pace a little bit from free practice as well, but definitely into qualifying, maybe slightly surprising, Andy Irwin, Peter Hickman as well, considering the BMW supposedly was still running their stock engine, which is amazing to think. I mean, especially given we know Thruxton is a fast, fast track.
See, this is the thing. I wasn't surprised to see Hickey or Andy Irwin up there.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess the Hondas do go well at Thruxton, yeah.
If you think back, Snetterton, they always go well, because that's where Jason O'Halloran took his win for Honda, and Dan Linfoot's been up on the podium there as well. Donington Park, Chavy Forrest was up on the podium on a regular basis. It's the fast and flowing, because it was the national circuit, not the bottom geared international circuit. The Honda is a quick motorcycle. There's no doubt about it. It has all the power it needs.
You have expected Chavy to be ahead of Andrew?
No, because he's never been to Thruxton before.
Okay.
So, no, I wouldn't, because it's such a unique circuit, and it is such a fast, fast circuit that, no, I wouldn't expect him to be up there at all. No, he was up there at Donington because he'd raced there in World Superbike, so he knew which way it was going. Unfortunately, at Thruxton, there are no test days. There aren't any, you know, let's have a quick sneak peek and take a road bike down and see which way it goes. When you rock up on Friday, that's the first time you see, or Thursday night for the track walk, that's the first time they'll have seen it. And the same with Scott Redding. So, no, Andy Irwin was fast there on Shane Byrne's PBM Ducati last year. I think he was basically attached to his brother's back wheel for most of the weekend. Without checking the results from last year, I believe he put it on the front row as well. So he has no shortage of bravery, that boy. And Hickey last year with his kidney infection still managed to put it on pole, if not win a race. So yeah, it wasn't too much of a surprise to me.
But maybe it was a surprise to see the other Thruxton rookie, Scott Redding, comprehensively stick it on pole ahead of Tommy Bridwell in second and Pete Hickman in third.
Isn't it just getting boring talking about him now?
I mean, I think he's, you know, I think we talked about this before. He's definitely seems to have established an MO for when it comes to qualifying, because sure, I definitely saw him back out, you know, behind Josh Brooks when Josh was putting in some fast laps. I mean, I think he pretty much had the track figured out, but I think he just used Josh just to see if there's anything else he could still learn and anything else.
He's been doing that, I think, at almost every track this season.
Yeah, and it's paying off.
It really is. I wonder if there's something written in Brooksy's contract that he has to tow Scott Redding round at most rounds, because during qualifying, he doesn't leave him alone.
Well, it's hard because I know, like, Josh tries to get out there like really quick and really early so he can get some laps in on his own. But Scott and I guess his crew chief has just got it figured out.
And this is JB's backyard as well, because he's won six of the last eight races at Thruxton, and it's one that he always seems to excel at. So he was always going to be there or thereabouts across the weekend. You weren't going to count him out, or Hickman, or Andy Irwin, Jason O'Halloran. He loves the place as well, because he can really let the bikes dance through those church and village corners, and that's something that Jason likes to do. He likes to get the rear spinning. It might not be the fastest way through, but my God, it looks beautiful.
Some of the other people I was looking down, Danny Kent in 17th, I thought that was pretty creditable, considering the lack of running time they've had with that bike.
Yeah, he knew which way the track went. Because before they went to Snetterton, he had, I think, 7 or 11 laps of Thruxton. They managed to catch a day where they could get an entry for it. And that was Danny's first ever sit on the MV Agusta. It was still in World Superbike trim at the time. So he had all the World Superbike whistles and bells. It was just a shakedown test to get him comfortable, you know, bars, foot pegs, levers, that kind of thing. But at least he had an idea of which way the circuit went. And, you know, I was quite impressed by Danny this weekend. Not an easy circuit to go to put in a fast time. And we had problems with Hector Barbera on Friday in FP1 having an almighty crash. I think he had two crashes over the weekend. One of them he sustained a leg fracture from. So he was, pardon the pun, on the back foot most of the weekend. Taron McKenzie crashed out in Q1. Joe Francis launched his beautiful new 2019 BMW at the scenery, breaking a bone in his hand. So he missed the weekend as well. The Suzuki's just still struggling to find whatever it is they need to find. I'm not sure even they know anymore what they need to find. As both the Build Base and the OMG boys aren't where they really want to be. It's not through lack of trying and endeavour, but there just seems to be something missing with the Suzukis at the moment to take them really into the top 10. Ryan Vickers, that's a fantastic showing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, considering he's still coming back from injury.
Yeah, and he's a rookie around the circuit as well on a superbike.
Yeah, and top Kawasaki.
He was
in seventh there. Yeah,
which is good. Which is, you know, quite a fair margin ahead of the next Kawasaki. He was seventh. Danny Buchan was next best, down in 12th. So yeah, it was a stunning display from Ryan Vickers.
So let's talk about race one. I can't even begin how to kind of walk through that, describe that or whatever. It was a bun fight from the beginning and it didn't let up until the end. I mean, I think we can probably talk about that. There was I know if it's a pride or a gaggle or a herd or certainly a group of riders who were basically in the mix for the win, but it pretty much was anybody from first down to 10th. I mean, you know, Andy Irwin, Pete Hickman, O'Halloran was in there, Christian Iden was in there, Bridewell, obviously, Reading, Buchan was up there, you know, Brooks as well. Reading, I think we've talked about this before, you know, was maybe still struggling to get that Ducati.
He just can't launch it, can he?
Off the line, no. So, but he doesn't seem to bother him. He just seems to settle in, you know, whether it's eighth or ninth or whatever. He doesn't panic. He just kind of takes his time. No crazy moves early on. Just settles in, finds a rhythm, gets some, you know, heat into the tires, and then just like slowly starts to inch his way forward. But
yeah, he's got confidence in his own ability, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But it was really, really hard. And then, you know, with all the scrapping and some great, great passing, especially into places like the chicane, I think one of the first fallers, unfortunately, came around about lap 9. And that was Matt Truelove, I think, who went down just in front of Ben Curry.
He did, which caused Ben to take avoiding action and eyes like saucers to avoid the stricken McCams Yamaha R1, the third of the McCams machines that run in British Superbikes, which put him on the literally, he was away from the rest of the pack at that point, so it was difficult for him to get back on terms. And he also then DNF'd the race on lap 15. So it was a tough old race for Ben Curry on his continued return from injury aboard the Quattro Plant JG Speedfit Kawasaki. And unfortunately, for all his endeavours in qualifying, unfortunately, Danny Kent, he retired on lap 11 with, it's no great surprise to be fair, but he actually retired with arm pump.
Yeah, initially I thought maybe the bike was giving him grief, but
that's
yeah,
because it's an MV, so you
that it wasn't, that it was arm pump. Hardly surprising, you know, you think of just the physicality of muscling a bike at that pace around that track. You know, I think my understanding was, you know, just he started to kind of get pins and needles and just, had to.
It's not a place to fall off, so he did the right thing. And when you think he hadn't ridden for 7 months, he had no testing prior to Snetterton. They turned up on the Friday and they were testing as they go. Yeah. So he hasn't, and the races didn't really go his way. So he hasn't had an awful lot of time on the motorcycle to then go to Thruxton and hang on to that thing while it rattles around there at ridiculous speeds on the side of the tyre. So yeah, it's wholly understandable that's what he suffered with, really. As a superbike rookie on his second race on a superbike after being on a Diddy bike for so long.
Diddy bike, yeah.
Well, yeah,
it was. I mean, you know, yeah, for sure. But then, yeah, just like I say, I mean, we just had this gaggle of riders. I think, you know, it was kind of O'Halloran was leading there for a while. You know, Hickman was up there. Andy Irwin was definitely always in the mix, sort of, you know, first, second. Brooks and Redding both made their way through, sort of being in contention for a podium. Yeah, I know. I must admit, I think it was about 3 laps to go, and there was a part of me that really, really, really wanted O'Halloran to take it. You know,
oh, yeah.
Still remembering back to the way he went out in the first round. I would have loved for him to see how he battled for that. But, you know, it was any of them. O'Halloran, Andy Irwin, Brooks Redding, all of them, I think, you know, could have taken the top 4. But
and that was the whole beauty of it. The whole beauty of it was is that I didn't care who won. You know, if Andy Irwin wins, brilliant. Debut win, fantastic. If Josh Brooks wins, that closes the championship up. If Scott Redding wins, then the whole crowd are going to go nuts. If Peter Hickman wins, fantastic, well deserved. You know, and you just think, my God, it does. It was just sitting there and just enjoying the racing. And the thing that I enjoyed most over the two races was that battle between Andy Irwin and Peter Hickman. That was as tasty as you like.
And what I have to say, I was impressed that Andy Irwin, you know, kept his head, kept it upright. You know, and he was battling hard and strong. I mean, he was so strong, so brave, especially into the chicane.
He's an ultra-aggressive rider. He always has been.
You know, how many passes did he put in at that point? Really, really impressive
to
see.
He was absolutely nailed on, wasn't he? I was so impressed with him. And, you know, keeping his head, as you say, when all about were doing their best to lose theirs. But I think it was all fair racing. It was all close, and there was a few bumps and barges and excuse me's and do you mind if I don't? But it was, in essence, it was all fair racing. Scott Redding put some tremendous passes on both into the first complex and the second complex. The second complex going round the outside of Andy Irwin to cut back again and make the apex of the second part of club was just stunning. And one thing that I have been looking at, as we have our learned friends at TSL Timing, I always use, I know you do as well, we use their data for our conversation so we can see everything where it is. One thing we don't do, dear listeners, is go into the PDF book, which gives you sector times, best sectors, top speeds, and all the other little bits of information that anoraks like me really enjoy looking at. I really should get out more. It's just a sad fact of my life that I like those things. And you have all your sector times and your ideal lap and all the good nitty gritty things that you can really sink your teeth into. But when you have a look on TSL Timing, it gives you the best lap on the second to last column. And the very last column, it tells you what lap they did it on. Now, when you look at the lap chart for Thruxton for race one, the average lap that people put their fastest lap in was lap three of a 20 lap race. Now, if that isn't at the tire with people with their minds on their tire early, let's get a lap in early, get a fast lap, let's get settled in, and then we'll manage it from there. But the times kind of do drop off a cliff as the race goes on. So as you look through lap three, lap three, lap two, lap three, lap two, lap three, lap two, lap three, three, five, three, lap five there for Ryan Vickers is quite impressive. But then you'd maybe expect that from a rookie. And then lap six for Luke Stapleford, another rookie in the series. There's a pattern forming. Hector Barbera, lap five. David Allingham, lap six. So there's your rookies to the championship, finding their feet and getting quicker under race pace. But the series regulars all put their fastest laps in on laps two or three.
You know, you can imagine that early on they're sort of all getting duffed up a little bit, and it's hard to get away to put in those fast laps. And equally, you also imagine too, as the weight, as the petrol burns off and the weight of the bike comes down, you might see some flying laps a little bit later on. Yeah, but I think you're right. You know, to your point, that just shows you how abrasive and how hard Thruxton is on the tyres, where, you know, by lap three, lap four, that's it. You've had the best of the tyres, and now you're just hanging on.
Absolutely. And I've actually surprised myself that by looking at the rookies, because they are all lap five and six. Ben Curry, Danny Kent, Matt Truelove, laps five, six and five respectively.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was a great race. The last lap especially I thought was really, really good, because there was like about four riders in it and you really, really didn't know who was going to take it. And Redding as well just put the little cherry on the cake, made a really, really sweet move just to take Brooks.
O'Halloran
as well put a great pass on Brooks, but Brooks was able to fight back to keep third as well. So across the line, it was Andrew Irwin for Honda Racing taking his first win. And I mean, that is always great to see any rider taking their first win. You know,
of
that's going to be sweet too. Scott Redding followed him home in second, Josh Brook in third, and Jason O'Halloran in fourth.
Fabulous. And yeah, congratulations, Andy Irwin, Honda Racing, and Half Beltran and everyone involved. That's it's always good to see a team that have been working methodically all year get some just reward for the efforts that they put in. You don't want to see the same ones winning all the time, because it becomes almost predictable. So it's nice to see it mixed up. It's nice to see the Hondas up there. It'll be, whether they'll still be there at Cadwell, I'm not quite sure. I think the Ducatis will be hard to beat around Cadwell Park, but it'll just be, you would just take it for Andy Irwin for this race one, and congratulations to him. He's a nadgery.
But for me, this
boy
is the beauty of BSB. There is a sense there's such a mix of tracks, And for me, I think they've got a lot of the technical rules.
Yes.
So you can even up the performance of the bike. So, you know, when you look at all the events over a season, I think any sort of hardworking, well-run team with a little bit of luck and a determined rider, you know, has a chance to put it on the podium. But to take the top spot for Andrew after his season last year, but, you know, the good season, hard season he's had this year as well, I thought that was really, really sweet.
Absolutely agreed. And that put him on pole for race two as well. Looking at the grid for race two, Andy Irwin, Jason O'Halloran and Josh Brooks on the front row. James Ellison on the second row of the grid, courtesy of his fastest lap in race one. From Scott Redding, Dan Linfoot, Tommy Bridewell, Peter Hickman and Ryan Vickers. Unfortunately, Christian Iden, apart from his early showing on the opening half a dozen laps or so, he faded really badly in race one, and with a best lap time, unfortunately, that only put him 11th on the grid ahead of Luke Mossy. So difficult times for the usual suspects at the front. Danny Buchan as well on the fifth row.
Well, hang on a second, though. I mean, to be fair, though, what was Christian's lap time to get him on that 11th spot?
1:16.059.
And what was, say, I know, like Scott Redding's time?
1:16.023.
So Christian was how slow?
About a gnat's cock.
I mean, unfortunately, that is just the reality of BSB.
It could be worse. It looks
way, way worse. But fuck me. If someone said, the good news is you're 300ths off Scott Redding's time.
I know, I was only messing.
Yeah, you're two rows back. What?
and you lose out to Chavi Forres because his surname starts with F and yours starts with I.
Yes, that's the same time.
No, I actually think they go to the second fastest lap for that one. But that must have been really tight as well.
Yeah. But it was, I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, like, everyone's still in the 1:16s, even back to sort of like row 7 and 8.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were, if you look, literally a tenth of a second between James Ellison on 4th and Danny Buchan in 13th.
Yeah.
So, it was some seriously tight times. I wasn't being disrespectful to Christian Iden, I was just having a bit of a joke.
Now, race two was a little bit difficult because although they were lining up in the dry, it was definitely threatening some rain. And even some of the rider interviews I saw with James Wootton on the grid, you know, the riders knew that maybe there was some rain coming sort of about 20 minutes or so from the planned start.
Yeah, it was one of those, wasn't it? It's like, do we, don't we, do we hang on, do we... And it turned into a, not a farce, but it turned into a very difficult afternoon after such a fantastic race one. The staccato start to race two really made things, it dragged things out longer than necessary, which meant that the Supersport 300 race at the end of the day was cancelled because it overran so long, as for events that we'll discuss shortly. But yeah, it was one of those where the boys got away for the first part of the race. Jason O'Halloran, he led from Josh Brooks, Andy Irwin and Peter Hickman, the usual suspects, before Josh Brooks piled through into the lead, which was going to be the story of race two, really. Hickey wasn't far behind him, but then the battle between Scott Redding, Tommy Bridewell and Andy Irwin that ensued after that was very reminiscent of race one, and it was just fantastic to watch. But then, unfortunately, just as everything was heating up, and Scott Redding put in a fabulous pass going into the club chicane again, as he did in race one, into race two, but this time on Tommy Bridewell. Unfortunately, the rain flags came out and the race was stopped.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, it was difficult to tell. We started to see the marshals, I think, are able to put out the reduced adhesion, which is the red cross on the white background flags, of their own accord. They don't need race control. But we started to see those pop around the track. And then, of course, you know, as the viewer at home, you get to see the spots on the TV. So,
yes.
You know, they're on slicks. I don't know if they called it a little early, but it's one of these things you'd rather maybe kind of call it early. Give it some time just to see what the weather is going to do, and then call it a wet race to allow the riders and the teams to choose what tyres they want to put the riders out. But I did see, I don't think Redding seemed too impressed when he came into the pit lane.
No, because he was just finding his feet. And obviously, there were spots of rain in qualifying as well, but it's with it being quite an abrasive surface at Thruxton and quite warm weather that we've got in the UK at the minute, the rain, it needs to be quite a heavy shower to soak the track there. So they were a little bit tentative in qualifying, but then they got used to the conditions and headed on. One thing I do have, when we were watching race two, Jen and I watching it, if ever there's spots in a certain sector, Jennifer sits next to me and she starts singing, mental rain, she's just got a little rendition of her version of Prince's Purple Rain, whenever there's drops of rain in any sector, because that's her interpretation thereof. So, always entertaining. I just look at her and there it goes. But yeah, it was a strange restart to race two, because it was declared a wet race, but it was bone dry.
Well, yeah, so I think it was real short. And then to 13 laps, yes, with the grid based on the positions from lap 7, they had a crack at new tyres if they wanted them. But, I mean, maybe half of the teams had, you know, still had any fresh tyres left.
Sure.
So I don't know if that kind of was going to throw something into the mix. But I think, you know, once we got the start under the way, it was basically the same people who got the bike dialed in from the first portion of the race who were back into the front. I mean, Brooks was off like a scalded cat. And Hickenman definitely trying to chase him down with Andy Irwin. Ellison was there for a while as well, I think.
Courtesy of his second race start, yeah.
Yeah, courtesy of that. I think a little bit later on, we had a Tyco BMW go down.
Yeah, we did. Glenn Irwin, unfortunately, caught a curve at Club Chicane.
Yeah, and that was a bit, unfortunately, a bit nasty as well, because I think the bike went down and it took off the side of the engine casing, which meant some oil came out. So there was a bit of a fire, but then when they picked up the bike, there was quite a puddle of oil.
There was, wasn't
there? So, understandably, that then caused the second stoppage of race two, which was a red flag. As the marshals had to get out on track to tackle the small fire and pick up the bike, which was, by that point, I think it had slid into basically the racing line, the exit.
It had, very much so.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then, I mean, if you were watching this on TV, it's like everything stops again. And now we had like a good and a fairly intensive cleanup. They had pretty much every toy in the cupboard out trying to clean this up, because it was quite a mess.
It was an awful mess. And it helped... It didn't help me, because I think a lot of people had the same issue. Because it was a 45-minute delay after they'd already had a delayed first restart, I think the electronic program guides on either your BTTV, your Virgin or your Sky would only extend so far. We'd been out in Manchester in the morning and over lunchtime, so we were delayed watching the races anyway, because we'd gone for lunch in Manchester. And coming back, you could see it was extending each time. And I was keeping off social media because I didn't want to know what was going on. And you could see it when every time we paused it, either to make a brew or a nature break, whatever, you could see it had gone from like 5 hours, 15 minutes of recording, 5 hours, 30 minutes. So it was extending, extending, extending. And I think it got to 6 hours, something along those lines, and it stopped. And I think most people got the first three corners of the second race, and that was it. So people been trying to watch on catch up and trying to watch on BSB Extra and the highlight shows that come on with Greg Haynes on ITV4. It was just a shame that we went to watch it. It was like, we can't see it. And we had to watch the highlight show at 10:30 to catch race two. So it was a bit of a shame that we didn't catch at the time to enjoy the racing as we were.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame. And then, like you say, I mean, it was quite a cleanup operation. By the time they finished, they still had quite a line of cement dust coming out of the chicane. It was definitely on the racing line. So they set up another race start. I think it was down to 8 laps, basically a sprint. I mean, the interest from that point was, now there was no need to conserve tyres. You could just go pretty much flat out from the get-go.
No, but which they did played start into Josh Brooks' hands perfectly.
Yeah, they started off with 2 sighting laps. I think that way the riders could just get a sense of exactly what the conditions were and where the line was coming out that. But yeah, as soon as the lights went off, it was the same players. And I mean, I don't know if Brooks, either just because he had his eye in or because now he knew he didn't have to save the tyres. I mean, he went off at absolute light speed.
He did. And it was exactly that. It's the tyres will last 8 laps. And I think he tried to do that in the first restart, which was 13 laps, and he'd made a break in the first restart as well. So he knew exactly what he was doing. He'd get to the front and just nail it and goes, you know, almost putting in four or five qualifying laps just to get away from everybody else. And he succeeded. It was an imperious race from Josh Brooks, and it absolutely worked to perfection for him.
Yeah, I mean, the other guys were trying to stay in contact, swapping places, trying to chase him down. But, they couldn't really get anywhere near him. I think Andy Irwin and Hickman still carrying their pace from race one and for the whole weekend. But
they just didn't have anything. Paint at one point.
Oh, yeah, that was hilarious. So I saw that. I mean, I didn't think Andy Irwin's would pass was that was that kind of hard? And he put his little hand up.
It wasn't hard. He just doesn't give anybody any room. He's so close. When you watch through into Club Chicane and watching out the back through Allard's Village and Church, he doesn't mind riding pillion with anybody.
No, that was so funny. And then, you know, Hickman came straight back at him pretty much the next corner. And then just in classic form, up went the two fingers as he went through.
Fabulous. And there's been nothing heard of since from that. It was just good, hard racing. I think both of the boys enjoyed the scrap.
They were patting each other and laughing and giggling in Parc Fermé after. I don't think there was any issues from that. But I think, you know, the issue for that short eight-lap race was really came about from Scott Redding, who ran lap four. I don't know if he kind of outbroke himself or just got pushed a little while.
Yeah, I think he got nudged on the way into the final chicane, yeah.
Yeah, puts his hand up, you know, rejoins, looks behind him and slots back into the same place he left. I think he was eighth going into the chicane and he rejoined eighth.
Yeah.
So in some respects, sort of no harm, no foul, but that's not quite how it played out.
No, it isn't. And this is one thing that has irked me over from the weekend, not because it's Scott Redding, but because of what happened. On an eight-lap race, if the penalty for cutting the chicane was a long lap penalty because
they hang on a second. So it was he had to lose a second.
Yeah, this is what I was coming to. He had to go through that sector a second slower than he previously had. So not only does he have to yield back to the place that he came from, which is obvious and only good manners, but he actually has to roll off even more to go through the section to gain the time, to give the time back that they assume for cutting that section, of course.
I think there's a certain logic in that, because initially I just thought, he gave the place back, but I could also see that if you're 2 seconds behind someone,
yes,
and you're really struggling to sort of get in their slipstream, you know, you could sort of like go through the chicane, you know, give back the place, but then join right up his chuff.
Yeah.
So
it's got to be a bit of give and take. They were all together, so
but it's a pretty technical bit of rule making.
Yeah,
for a rider maybe to be 100% up with.
This is where there needs to be a little bit of common sense in the rules. It's an 8-lap dash. It's not a 20-lap race. This is lap four. This is half race distance. The boys are all still together. He'd given the place back, so he'd actually gained no advantage from where he was on track position.
Yeah, he had gained no benefit.
No, there was no benefit. He went into the chicane in eighth place. He came out of it in eighth place. So then he was present, because he went through that sector as quick as he'd done previously and not rolled off to the tune of a second, he was awarded a long lap penalty. The long lap penalty was shown to him on lap five. So it's like, okay, you got five. This is lap five. So you got 6, 7 to come in. You're not going to do it on the last lap. But the one thing for me about the long lap penalty, they got it wrong. And it's unusual for Stuart Higgs and his team. In my humble opinion, the long lap penalty was in the wrong place. The long lap penalty was through the first complex. You then run deep before the second part of the complex to take a wider turn, but you actually come out on the racing line for the right hander that goes after the complex. The prime example was in Supersport when Alistair Seeley took a long lap, and he almost came out on somebody's front wheel who was on the racing line going into that right hander.
Yeah.
So it was a strange place to put it. And I know why it's there and I understand that it's there. But I just thought that was a really, really strange place to put it. But then to give any whoever the rider would be, whether it was Andy Irwin, Peter Hickman, Scott Redding, is irrelevant. But to then hit them with a long lap penalty because they didn't do that first sector in a second slower than they had done previously on an 8-lap race just made it a little bit farcical almost. And then to hit the rider with a 15-second penalty, which is the equivalent penalty of a ride through at Thruxton.
Yeah, because he had what? I can't remember. I think the rule is you have 3 laps, is it?
Yeah, 3 laps to do it, and then you're black flagged.
And if you don't do the long lap penalty, then you have to do a ride through.
Oh, you get the ride through. Sorry, I know you got black flagged.
So obviously, by the time they got to the point of him having to do the ride through, basically the 8 laps are done.
The race was over. Yeah.
So they credited the 15. Now, I mean, he had a pit board saying that he had a long lap penalty. And that was definitely out for 2 laps.
Oh, sure. Yeah, rules are rules in that respect. And he should have taken the long lap.
He did see it, but he chose to not do it.
I fully understand that. That side of it I don't have an issue with. But the fact that it was an 8-lap race and he slotted back in position and then they still awarded the long lap penalty was a little bit disappointing for me. I appreciate rules are rules, not a problem. Stuart Higgs has a job to do, and Stuart Higgs operates to the letter of the law. I have no problem with that whatsoever. This is purely my personal opinion. I just thought it was harsh, and it doesn't matter who it is.
I think, though, there are areas in the rules where it specifically says that race direction has discretion.
Like jump starts.
And I think this was an area where it is not written that race direction have discretion.
Fair shout. Which is a shame.
Even if race direction had come up and said, the likelihood is it would have been appealed and they would have had no choice but to have to say, no, you're right, the rules say that. Now, whether that might change something.
It does. The rules are ever evolving, that's for sure.
And it was a pretty unique set of circumstances. The one thing that really impressed me, this is just me interpreting it, but Redding showed a lot of class because doubtless fuming about that, doubtless feeling.
He was. You could
unfair.
See when he pulled into pit lane and he wasn't
see
in park.
Any media, though, any tweets, any media, any interviews for about a day or two afterwards. When the next thing I saw about sort of 3 days later is basically, you know, Redding taking it on the chin, saying, no, you know, rules are rules. That's what it is. On to the next round.
Took a while, didn't it?
It did take a while. But I thought that was like fairly classy from.
Oh, without a doubt.
Was making sure.
I agree. It's not
take
like
his phone away
like,
from him.
Hang on.
Change his password.
I think we've both come out with we probably both have the same interpretation where it's like, that's bollocks. But no, rules are rules, and there's no slight on Stuart Higgs and his team. The punishment didn't seem to fit the crime. But yeah.
And it did deflect a little bit, I think, from what Josh Brooks was able to do.
Oh, he was imperious, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, with all the restarts as well, it would have been easy for him to lose his rhythm or to sort of get a bit distracted with all of that. But, I mean, he went out and did the business.
The only man in the 114s for the whole race.
Yeah, and obviously with him basically competing for the championship with Scott Redding, that meant he took the win, and Scott, unfortunately, was quite classified last and out of the points.
Which, an incredible end to the race. But I mean, Josh Brooks was fantastic. He won the race by 4.2 seconds in the end over 8 laps.
I know, over 8 laps.
Over 8 laps, yeah, 4 seconds.
Amazing.
Over 8 laps.
Amazing.
And I say he was the only one. He did a 1:14.6. I think the best one prior to that was Chavy Forrest did a 1:15.3.
Yeah, but most of them were doing sort of
1:15.5, 1:15.6. So really, he was just absolutely... Yeah, Scott Redding's best lap was a 1:16.1. Yeah. So to do that over 8 laps... I know Irwin and Hickman and Ho Halloran, you got me at it, were tripping each other up. So, he had a clear run. Once he got to the front and bolted, it was quite impressive to see. And that kind of turned the championship a little bit closer.
Yep, it did. And I think it also meant with Andy Irwin's run of form as well, I think it also changed who's in sixth spot.
It did, but he nudged his teammate out, didn't he?
Yeah, so Andy Irwin now is up into sixth, Terry Forrest down to seventh. Peter Hickman, which I was kind of a bit surprised, I thought he had a pretty decent weekend, you know, there in eighth. But, you know, you see the points different. Andy Irwin was able to add a 25 and a 20 to his total. Peter Hickman only an 11 and a 16 points. So, yeah, points mean prizes. That's what it is at the end of the day.
It's absolutely true. Hickey's best race weekend of the season so far, going into Cadwell Park. 18 points for Chavi Forres, 45 for Andrew Irwin over the weekend really made the difference. But looking at Taron McKenzie in fifth place, the last four rounds, he's only finished two races.
Yeah.
And he missed both the races at Brands Hatch after crashing and going unconscious during qualifying. He crashed out of the first race at Knock Hill, crashed out of the second race at Snetterton, and didn't compete at Thruxton at all. The gap between Taron McKenzie and Andy Irwin and Chavi Forres now is as tight as you like.
Yeah.
144 for Taz McKenzie, 139 for Andy Irwin, 132 for Chavi Forres, and then a little bit further back, 123 for Peter Hickman. If Taz McKenzie doesn't ride at Cadwell Park, his actual showdown position could well be under threat.
My guess is I think he will ride come hell or high water.
He has to.
Whether he will be able to be competitive with that injury, we'll just have to wait and see.
And because after that, the concern is that they go to Alton Park. And that's one place where at the moment, Taz on the R1 is like a flea on a dog's back.
Yeah, three rounds too.
Yeah, three races as well, which is, you know, that is going to be a struggle for him.
Yeah.
Andy Irwin wasn't so great there back in May, but people have progressed since then. And whether Taz will still be carrying the effects of that injury by then will remain to be seen. But it could be touch and go. And I said touch and cloth. It could be touch and go for Taron McKenzie to make it into the showdown.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I look back too at Peter Hickman's results as well, you know, he just seems to be sort of progressively getting stronger with that BMW package.
Very much, very much so. And he was fairly he had a good round at Alton Park early in the season as well, despite the bike being in its infancy back then and the progress that it's made since. Cadwell Park is going to be a fantastic weekend, but Alton Park is going to be something seriously special because of the pressure of those last two showdown places. I think Danny Buchan's fairly safe now where he is, although he is only, 6 points ahead of Taron McKenzie. One slip-off, as Danny Buchan did at Cadwell Park last year when he nearly threw his bike at the Med Centre. Thank you for the catch fencing that it didn't make it. There's an awful lot of points and prizes still to play for. Early in the season, we thought it was, you know, it was looking kind of cut and dried and maybe it was just that one last place that was up for grabs. It really isn't. I think anybody down to eighth place, Christian Idem, I'm not quite sure. He's 21 points back on Peter Hickman, so I think maybe that's a big ask. But there's five races left yet.
Just looking down at the rest of the race too, now, we saw Suzuki, unfortunately, it had a pretty hard time at Thruxton. I'm sure they'll be happy to move out. Luke Mossy was top Suzuki finisher for OMG in ninth place. His teammate, Josh Elliott, down there in 15th. The other two Suzukis as well, Luke Stapleford and Bradley Ray, 12th and 13th. So not outstanding. I think Danny Buchan was the top Kawasaki rider there.
He was because Ryan Vickers crashed in the opening segment, didn't he?
Yeah.
He crashed at Club.
And it turns out later after the event, we found out there was another casualty, and that was James Ellison. Finished 11th, and turned out that this was really going to be his make or break round. And unfortunately, he and BMW Smith's Racing parted company at the end of that round.
They did. I mean, it wasn't a huge shock to a lot of people. James's results have been nowhere near what he's capable of as a rider. And while Pete's doing what he's doing with the package that he has, the team built James Ellison a brand new bike for Thruxton weekend on the, exactly the same spec that Hickey's riding. And, you know, apart from a couple of fast laps, I mean, he went backwards fairly quickly in race two, despite his race one good lap. He went backwards fairly quickly, and it's well documented on various places that he has a lot going on in his personal life at the moment, whether that's affecting him, whether that injury that he suffered towards the end of last season with his back, the back injury that he complained about after the end of the season and explained to people what the problem was. Who's to say that that hasn't flared up again and is affecting him? Because he didn't come out and say that that was the case towards the end of last season. So why would he come out and say that that was the case now? So really, it's no big surprise. There's a lot of people that have in various threads on Crash and Bike Sport News and things like that. They're quite eager to stick the boot into James Ellison. James is still a strong rider. James is still a decent British superbike rider. Whether anybody else will take a punt on him after his performance this year, whether McCams will get him as a stand-in for Taz McKenzie if he doesn't ride at Cadwell Park, who knows? Unlikely, but he's now the spare man of British superbikes. But it just remains to be seen whether anybody will take the punt on him again after 18 months of lackluster results, really.
And any guesses who might take that seat for Cadwell?
No, I don't think anybody will, purely because I don't think there's anybody out there. The other thought I had for the McCams ride was a guest ride for Alex Lowes.
Right, okay.
As a factory Yamaha rider, that was just a thought I had. I haven't asked the McCams Yamaha press officer about it, because I think he's been mainly in Manchester this week on holiday, so I haven't bothered Ollie. But that was just a throwaway thought that I had.
I was wondering if there'd be any Stock 1000 riders, because, I mean, the Stock 1000 Championship's pretty much decided. So I thought that, I wondered if there would be anybody from the Stock 1000 who might come up to take that seat.
Maybe, but there isn't anybody on a Yamaha seat, is there, if they wanted to keep it in-house in that respect?
I was talking about BMW Smiths.
Oh, sorry, I'd moved on to the McCams ride just in case Taz couldn't make it. Yeah, why not? I mean, is it worth giving Chrissy Rouse a shot again? Is it worth, you know, is it worth giving somebody like that a go? It's a tough one. Excuse me while I just scroll down and we can have a look at...
I think it was, you know, the question was more just to see, because I know, you know, you kind of have... you have friends in high places, but I know you have friends in low places as well. I'm just, you know, curious if you'd heard any rumbles or grumblings or murmurs. Or...
No, I haven't. No, because, I mean, who else is on a BMW? Alex Olsen. He's on the IMR BMW, and he's not in contention because it is literally between Richard Cooper, Taylor McKenzie. T-Mac's on a BMW, but he's not going to want to jeopardise his Stock 1000 chance. I know he's 30 points behind Coops, but Coops was beaten at Thruxton, so there's every opportunity for Taylor McKenzie to close that gap before the end of the season, and I don't think he would want to jeopardise that by running a superbike at the same time.
Okay, well, it was just a question, because, I mean, we know it's a pretty competitive
with
ride.
A really
it's a pretty competitive
elongated
team.
Answer.
I know, I was hoping you were going to kind of scoop some fantastic... like.
No, because I can't see anybody that will come out of stock for it.
I know. I keep checking my phone as well. No one's called.
They're definitely not going to call me. That's a fact. But then, what do we have the week after? Yeah, we were at Cadwell Park. And I can't fucking wait.
16th to the 18th of August, yeah. Cadwell Park.
Friday, Saturday,
you sir
Sunday.
Will be down there?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and possibly Thursday night for what has been dubbed, quite cheekily, the Scott Redding test. There's an official BSB test from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. on the Thursday before The race weekend kicks off on the Friday morning, and it has cheekily been dubbed the Scott Redding test.
All the photographers will be catching him over the mountain, I think.
Absolutely. And Derek Cabrera, the good Lord Derek Cabrera, in attendance on race day as well.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. I'll have to catch up with you and him and find out how that went.
Excellent. So excited.
Dave, thanks very much for giving us your time.
Pleasure.
This week, it was great to catch up with you. Yeah, it was great to talk through some of the BSB and some of the other news and bits and pieces. So you got a good weekend planned?
Working tomorrow, then over to Jen's on Sunday. And then next week, we'll see what we find out about redundancies and things like that. So it's a mixed week coming up, but it should all be good fun. Everything happens for a reason, so we're quite positive about things. Let's just see what comes. What about you?
Just enjoying the good weather here. I think we'll probably be out on the lake as early as we can before the heat builds. And then, yeah, just sort of out and about, down the stables, all the usual stuff, walking the dog, and then catching up with the Grand Prix.
Gale force winds and thunderstorms, so we won't be going near any lakes.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
Andy, thank you so much, mate. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thanks to John as well for the Suzuka 8 Hour. I really enjoyed that. And we'll see you again in a couple of weeks' time.
Yep, catch up soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.